Hi, welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees, and we're about to spin the dials on our wireless to tune into the poetry of radio with a program called Radio Waves. In 1998, British poet and broadcaster Sean Street was asked by the BBC to write a sequence of poems about sound. This sparked the idea to gather poems that celebrate the wireless and its ability, like poetry, to strike matches in the mind of the listener. Today we hear from Sean and a selection of poems from his collection, Radio Waves. We will hear poems about radios that spew hate and dogma, poems wrapped in nostalgia for voice long gone, and the cold poetry of information transmitted in the daily shipping forecast. For Poetica, we explore poems that speak to the power of radio.
Listen to this, Kemp. Take the headphone. Can you hear anything?
Yes, there it is.
The letter S?
Distinctly, Mr. Marconi. Peck it, come here and listen.
In May 1897, Marconi sent the first radio message across water, from Lavernock in South Wales to Flatholm in the Bristol Channel. The message was the letter S.
The result meant much more to me than the mere successful realization of an experiment. As Sir Oliver Lodge has stated, it was an epoch in history. I now felt for the first time absolutely certain that the day would come when mankind could be able to send messages without wires, not only across the Atlantic, but between the furthermost ends of the earth.
Radio, like poetry, strikes matches in the mind.
S. Hiss. Primal sound. Default letter from which all speech, music, books were born. Dot, dot, dot. Morse for white noise. The first trip radio made over water carried as its luggage S. Waves across waves, it told the sea a story in its own voice. A tale of water on a shingle beach. In hyperspaces between stations, radio reverts to sibilance, to S, the universal broadcast of a plural. Maybe Marconi was weaned on a word made to be whispered. Sarsaparilla. Dark juice of underground forced up on a breath between palate and tongue. S in Morse without O S. Save. Just save. He was too uncertain of his soul. Does radio have a half-life, weakening as it loops and loops the world? Somewhere in a dripping cave where wireless goes to die, Marconi's S curls like a paper message washed out of its bottle. Obsolete distress calls dumped by radio waves in rock pools glow like ripe cherry anemones. I fished some out and held against my ear the faded Maydays, tragic as Titanic luggage, unpacked now by scientists, silk and lace falling from their folds like shimmering spirits. White roses, as sensitive as crystal sets, planted at the end of each row of vines. If there's sickness in the air, roses will fall first, and precious champagne grapes are sprayed and netted. So it was with the earliest receivers. They would catch a voice and die with it. Marconi's voice. Sarsaparilla was my first, water glass my last, but I will keep one more S back, So when my tomb is unsealed, I will hiss through parchment lips, and then my face, my origami death mask, will be shocked to dust by open air. Wild track. Radio with no voices, music, codes, the sound of unmarked canvas. At the end of each recording, 30 seconds nothing, a shared stillness. Actors, audiences, engineers, all honor it because the dumb deserve a hearing. And wireless always ends in silence. Michael Simmons Roberts. Wireless.
Before there was print, there was poetry. Poetry was a spoken form before it was a print form. In a sense, the printing press hijacked poetry from the oral tradition of Homer and the troubadours. So really, I think radio has the potential to reclaim the orality for poetry and give it back to the ear. I'm Sean Street. I'm a writer and broadcaster. I'm emeritus professor at Bournemouth University, and I continue to write poetry and make radio programs. Radio is an ideal medium for poetry because it's coming at you out of darkness. It's coming at you where you're concentrating on pure sound. Essentially radio, because it applies to the imagination all the ideas of the maker, it forms a partnership with the listener. Early pioneers of radio around the world got the technology. They understood that, but they also really got the poetry of it, understood the strangeness, the unexplainable, the profound nature of this means of communication.
Gillian Clark. On Air. Tools of my father's art. Old radios of fretted wood and bakelite. In a sanctum of shot silk curtained window, crystal or valve lurked in its holy light. I turned the knob. The needle wavered on through crackling distances. Paris, Luxembourg, Hilversum, past the call sign of some distant station, a lonely lightship where infinity scrambles to a hum, the Chinese whispers of a jabbering world. And now, by transistor and satellite, we hear Beethoven in Berlin sooner than if we were there, on airwaves the speed of light. And when the wall crumbled, we heard the first stone fall before they could. We watch storms darken the map from the crow's nest of the weather satellite. Hear the swallow's foot on the wind's telegraph before she comes to rest. The sun dried to a pallet in her throat. Still lodged at the wing feather's bloodroot, a grain of desert sand. And on my car a veil of strange red dust. James Priory. Emma and the Radio. You find a box beneath the bed and somehow switch it into life. Then gently tease a metal thread until it flowers above your head, bristling at the knowingness of your fingers. You joyride the dials, freewheel the frequencies, detonating syllables like someone shouting in their sleep. You slide along slip roads of whispers, spaces between stations which hiss like traffic in rain, or pebbles rattling in the lungs of a river. And then you're on your feet again, padding away in pajamas to raid your sister's room. You leave the buzzing box behind, deaf to its persistent shh. Edward Story. The Wireless Aerial. for David Twig. Twice as high as the clothesline, it went from pole to pole like rigging over the deck of our garden. Because of it, we could hear people speaking in London and Big Ben tolling silence for the evening news. There wasn't much that Ariel couldn't do. Music, plays, and comedians filled up the house like favorite relatives. How words which were invisible came through the air to drop the world right on our doorstep puzzled me. But pole to pole was nearer to the truth than we perceived. One Sunday morning came the thin, dry voice of Neville Chamberlain. We sat in autumn stillness round the room as mourners waiting for a funeral. I felt our Ariel had let us down. Yet what I now remember most is not the war, the sirens, or the bombs, but how a blackbird always sang from the tall and rough-hewn mast high as our roof, its notes vibrating in a clear blue glass of sky. He and the blossom on the garden wall became a well of indescribable delight from which those echoes now return. And nothing can destroy that world, though words remain as difficult to find as wavelengths lost among the stars.
I think it comes back to composition and instinct and feeling and the ear, what the ear is telling us. Just as a radio producer will know when a phrase has to be in a program, just as a certain sound belongs next to another sound, we feel our way through darkness, and the things we touch on the way are sounds, and we've touched one sound and yes, that feels right, and bring that together with another sound and so forth. And we move beyond words into a world where the sounds become the poem, the whole experience becomes the poem, and the sheer making becomes the poem.
Louis McNeice, from Autumn Sequel. To found a castle in the air requires a mint of golden intonations and a mound of typescript in the tray. What was in print must take on breath, and what was thought be said. In the end there was the word, at first a glint, then an illumination overhead, where the high towers are lit. Robert Minhinnick, Shortwave. I try to tune in, but Europe's blurred voice becomes stranger with the movement of the dial. All stations seem to give a fragment of performance. Mozart disarmed by a fizzled prodigy, innumerable cliques of wordsmiths. As the electric crackles, I make believe I am composing an avant-garde symphony, a sound poem for a hall of idiot speech. But behind the static are moments of sanity. A string quartet and interesting chanteurs, then histrionics at a play's climax. For some reason, a hubbub of languages and dim music becomes more important than any scheduled program. It suits my mood, perhaps, this indecipherable mayhem of newscasters and sopranos and the long returns to electronic gibbering. Somewhere, behind a rock band's sudden squall, a Morse message is tapped out. For a few seconds, it is clear, articulate, before melting into Europe's verbiage. It was not Mayday. And I twist the dial a hair's breadth into jazz. Keith Bennett, 99.9 FM Radio Nostalgia. Ah, But when I was young, there was this hiss that burnt the bedsheets close to my lips as Luxembourg ran out of steam again and slipped once more into a state of bliss. The knowledge that what should have been on show was missing in the channel or above it was enough to keep me mouthing out the words until the gruff hiss resolved itself into the faint strains of a song I let grow back into the solid state sound. For I was young, and this was radio at the cutting edge of music, and the rhythmic motion of my bed was innocence. This was Americana in a radio bell that had to be rung louder than the broom from the floor below, which never failed to make me jump. Outstanding, man. Excellent.
This is just a little skit on the very strict censorship with which radio entertainers have to contend. Now, the BBC once wrote to me and said, "Dear Norman Long, we thought you'd like to face the mic with your piano smile and song. So will you bring your repertoire along for us to see, to go over it with a pencil of the blue variety?" So I looked my list of songs up, to the studio I flew. I said, "Here's a nice song called Violets." They said, "Oh, that's much too blue." I said, "Is Robin Adair all right?" They said, "Robin Adair, my head. Just think of the bald-headed men you'll upset. We can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up to please the listening throng. I said, "Now here's a good one, the Vulgar Boatman song." But they hated vulgar boatmen and discouraged vulgar chat. And songs about rude sailors are barred. We can't let you broadcast that. So I looked my list of songs up and found an army one. "There's Something About a Soldier," but they said that can't be done. "There's Something About a Soldier" would get over nice and pat. "To a sergeant's wife with 14 kids, we can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up. I was getting fed up to the roots. Now here's a good song by Kipling, a military song called Boots. He said, "My dear good fellow, do you realise what you're at? You're advertising a chemistry firm. We can't let you broadcast that." So I packed my list of songs up and said, "Hang it, I won't sing. Would you like some Adagio Dancing or A Spot of Conjuring? Trick Cycling, Walk the Tightrope, I'm a darn good acrobat." And I'd love to tell you what they said, but I can't even record that.
One of the things that I use in is the metaphor of a Japanese temple bell. When you strike a bell, it begins with attack, it begins with a physical blow, and gradually that cacophonous sound that is exacted by that act gradually decays, gradually grows to silence, and we know that the silence comes, but we don't actually know when the silence comes. It goes beyond human hearing. So from the, if you like, the technology of the bell, we have something that links the physical world with the spiritual world, the imaginative world, whatever you want to call it, and moves us into silence, into a place where we imperceptibly go without realizing we've arrived. And we are transmitting not words or even just sounds, but ideas and images that linger on in the mind after the program is finished, just as the imaginative sound of the bell lingers on long after we can no longer hear it.
Anthony Dunn, Radio. What sounds like the broadcast of snow itself among mountains visible only by the absence of stars is the radio's wheezing stagger between its lost stations. Half an hour of the sky's current affairs murmur in the back of the car as we order orange digits this way and that in the dashboard's familiar dark, until a voice stags the black-white airwaves. She announces herself like the smell of cocoa or of grandparents' bed linen, turns the radio's display to a hearth. Auntie Jean, anachronist in between the songs of her Sunday night music show, talks us through unguessable locks and drops of this road through the highlands and the snow mothing our headlights, Outside this warm space, untold deer, in their camouflage, adjust their antenna to the white-noised engine, deaf to the one broadcast passing through them. "She's not really called Auntie Jean," she says, as the radio loses her, and the dark air empties itself again of everything but darkness and the snow.
Perhaps because we always hear sound in the instant, in the present, a note of music, a cry, an ejaculation from a voice, it is happening at that moment. Just like this second, now, this second, it's gone as soon as it's said or sounded. But for that moment, it is ever present, it's with us. Sound is us. It proves we are here because we've uttered it, made it, or heard it. When I was a child, I lived by the sea, and my going to sleep at night as a child was accompanied on foggy nights by a foghorn on the headland. Now, all foghorns have their own identity. Now, if you played me a recording of that foghorn, I would immediately respond with a whole memory bank relating to my childhood and to the circumstances in which I heard it. That's how potent I believe sound is for us as a medium to connect ourselves between the present and the past and give us a sense of self back. Desmond Graham, The Wireless. Elgar started it, and Elgar finished it. The episode my father and I wallowed in, and I feared, brought terror round the corner twice a week. Great expectations, the actors' names unknown then to me and now. The novel later read, with the pictures by Cruikshank or Fizz, judged not by pages and stories beside them, but by shapes and shadows decorating the whole room, without changing the wallpaper, stoking the fire. The wireless carried its voices like cloud delivering people from all over London, brought the whole east coast of England, its tides, its fog and foghorns, up the cold staircase, onto the landing and through all night to my bed.
Another shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office at 2343 on Saturday the 18th. There are warnings of gales.
I very quickly discovered when I started researching for radio waves how many poets, British poets, who had written poems about the British shipping forecast. Why should that be? It's perhaps because a weather forecast, and in particular a marine forecast, which cites specific places and gives you a series of numbers, is what I call the cold poetry of information. It's about spectacular places reinterpreted in an apparently unemotional way, and therefore connecting us with those places, setting images in our minds, but giving us this rather strange mixture of statistics and a sense of place. It's, in a sense, the essence of radio distilled down to this one thing, because it's saying, here's a clue, if you like, a seed, you let it grow.
Low, 250 miles northeast of the Faroes, 956, moving steadily north and deepening 940 by 1800 Sunday.
I wrote this poem after I was making a programme actually in Northern Ireland, in the northern part of Ireland, in Donegal, where Southern Ireland comes round and sort of wraps itself slightly round Northern Ireland. I was with a fisherman and his wife, and we were approaching the time when the marine forecast, the shipping forecast as we call it, was about to come on Radio 4, and I realised I was losing his attention. Shipping forecast, Donegal, They have shared still late October. But salt stones and a broken tree, the peeled paint on the lifeboat house, chime with places where the glass falls, prime saucers encountering night's bald predictions. Everywhere, winter edges in. And now the time is 10 to 6. Lightness and weight. Air's potentials pressed into words. Implication. Here, on all coasts, listening grows passionately tense. Fair Isle, Faroes, Southeast Iceland, North at Sierra, South at Sierra, Fisher, German Bight, Tyne, Dogger.
Fisher, German Bight, Tyne, Dogger.
This pattern of names on the sea. Weather's unlistening geography paves water. Beyond the music, the singing of sounds, this minimal chanting, this ritual paired to the bone, becomes the cold poetry of information. The litany edges closer. Lundy, Fastnet, and Irish Sea. Routine enough, all just routine. Always his eyes guessing beyond the headland, she perhaps sleeping, no words spoken. He stretches forward to grasp it, clasps his radio place. And now the weather reports from coastal stations. And then, Malin Head. Such routine that she barely glances up, but hears. Now falling.
Louis Aragon. Translation, Rolf Humphreys. From Little Suite for Loudspeaker. Hilversum. Kalimborg. Brunnen. The loud world over. Monday to Sunday, the idiot radio spits germs on Mozart, dedicates to you silence, its endlessly insulting brew. Loud Jove, in love with Io, queen of cows, has left her tethered by the waterside. She hears by radio at eventide cracklings of static from the hidden spouse. Like her, for this is war, hearing the voice, men stay in their stupidity and caress Toulouse, PTT, Deventry, Bucharest. Their hope, the good old hope of former days, interrogates the ether, which replies that Carter's little liver pills are best. On April 18th, 1930, the BBC announced, "There is no news today." Moscow is yelling down the line. The cooperation of socialism. Washington bites back too loud. Capitalism's diversity. London reasonably weighs each consideration, turning its back, some observers note, to balance argument. I balance mere sound, tired of it all. Quotidian surfeit of events, unfit for human consumption, analysis, comment, the puke of half-chewed news, goose-stepping endless information fires language's gaunt crops. Once upon a time, the voice of truth calmly announced, "There is no news tonight." Now the slots must always be filled, on the hour, every hour. So at dawn on this thin Monday, the talking head reads once more the bulletin he read all night before. Then, having a few seconds still to fill, tells me what I need to know. It is the first day of spring, official, but here in London there is heavy rain. I think how beyond these soundproof walls its acid digests the stone carvings of St. Mary Lestrand and spreads in waves like radio to the Urals, blighting Europe's trees, and miss my cue. Silence, and the red light glows. I hit a switch, then fade the sig to time. Time may come when again there will be no news. The producer's recurring nightmare. Dead air. Endless dead air. Julian May. On the air. Charles Bennett. The Drowned Radio. Recovered by fishermen who saw a chest of gold below them, its casing warped like ribs of carp, its needle stuck on Hilversum. This silted brain is working perfectly still. Stand by the water for a while as a swan swims once round the island. Soon you'll become attuned to the soft conversation of clouds, and notice how a minnow's heart ticks with the drizzle of static.
I love silence. I've noticed when I've been writing radio features and scripts for features, so often the first word I write on a piece of paper is the word silence. But I love the idea of silence. I love the idea of silence beginning a program and a program growing out of silence. I have a recording of Under Milkwood, the original BBC broadcast of Under Milkwood with Richard Burton. And I treasure it because it contains the original BBC studio announcement before it. So it begins Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas. And then there are 7 or 8 seconds of silence before out of that silence comes the voice of Richard Burton saying,
"To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow-black fishing boat bobbing sea."
And the question is almost a kind of Zen philosophical question. Where does the program begin? Does it begin with a radio announcer? Does it begin with Richard Burton's first words? For me, it begins somewhere in the 7 or 8 seconds between the two, in that moment of infinite possibility that silence can give us. I've noticed also that poets who broadcast observe this fact, that at the end of a broadcast, we have a moment of silence in the studio, which is recorded silence, recorded ambience, as though everything returns back to silence.
Charles Tomlinson, in the studio. Recorded ambience. This is what they call silences put back between the sounds. Leaves might fall onto the roof glass to compound an instant ambience from the drift of sibilance. But winter boughs cannot enter. They distort like weed under the glass water. This sifted silence, now recording, 1 minute only of it, comprises what you did not hear before you began to listen. The sighs that, in a giant building, rise up, trapped between its soundproof surfaces, murmuring, replying to themselves, gathering power like static from the atmosphere. You do hear this ambience? It rings true, for silence is an imagined thing.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, that was Radio Waves, poems celebrating the wireless. You heard from Professor Sean Street, whose collection of poems is called Radio Waves. The reader was Nicholas Coughlin. The sound engineer was Richard Gervin, and it was produced by Miyuki Jokaranta, who also threw some sounds into the mix. Visit the Poetica website for details of poems and publications, or to leave us a comment. In our next podcast, we'll be featuring a new anthology of work by Asian Australian poets.